Tuck Everlasting by Natalie Babbitt. Read by Peter Thomas. If you're following along in your book, please turn to the prologue. Prologue. The first week of August hangs at the very top of summer, the top of the livelong year, like the highest seat of a Ferris wheel when it pauses in its turning. The weeks that come before are only a climb from balmy spring, and those that follow a drop to the chill of autumn. But the first week of August is motionless and hot. It is curiously silent, too, with blank white dawns and glaring noons and sunsets smeared with too much color. Often at night, there is lightning, but it quivers all alone. There is no thunder, no relieving rain. These are strange and breathless days, the dog days, when people are led to do things they are sure to be sorry for after. One day at that time, not so very long ago, three things happened, and at first there appeared to be no connection between them. At dawn, May Tuck set out on her horse for the wood at the edge of the village of Tree Gap. She was going there as she did once every 10 years to meet her two sons, Miles and Jesse. At noontime, Winnie Foster, whose family owned the Tree Gap wood, lost her patience at last and decided to think about running away. And at sunset, a stranger appeared at the Foster's gate. He was looking for someone, but he didn't say who. No connection, you would agree. But things can come together in strange ways. The wood was at the center, the hub of the wheel. All wheels must have a hub. A Ferris wheel has one, as the sun is the hub of the wheeling calendar. Fixed points they are, and best left undisturbed, for without them, nothing holds together. But sometimes, people find this out too late. 1. The road that led to Tree Gap had been trod out long before by a herd of cows, who were, to say the least, relaxed. It wandered along in curves and easy angles, swayed off and up in a pleasant tangent to the top of a small hill, ambled down again between fringes of bee-hung clover, and then cut sidewise across a meadow. Here, its edges blurred. It widened and seemed to pause, suggesting tranquil bovine picnics. Slow chewing and thoughtful contemplation of the infinite. And then it went on again and came at last to the wood. But on reaching the shadows of the first trees, it veered sharply, swung out in a wide arc, as if for the first time it had reason to think where it was going, and passed around. On the other side of the wood, the sense of easiness dissolved. The road no longer belonged to the cows. It became instead, and rather abruptly, the property of people. And all at once, the sun was uncomfortably hot, the dust oppressive, and the meager grass along its edges somewhat ragged and forlorn. On the left stood the first house, a square and solid cottage with a touch-me-not appearance, surrounded by grass cut painfully to the quick and enclosed by a capable iron fence some 4 feet high, which clearly said, "Move on. We don't want you here." So the road went humbly by and made its way past cottages more and more frequent, but less and less forbidding, into the village. But the village doesn't matter, except for the jailhouse and the gallows. The first house only is important. The first house, the road, and the wood. There was something strange about the wood. If the look of the first house suggested that you'd better pass it by, so did the look of the wood, but for quite a different reason. The house was so proud of itself that you wanted to make a lot of noise as you passed, and maybe even throw a rock or two. But the wood had a sleeping, other-world appearance that made you want to speak in whispers. This, at least, is what the cows must have thought. Let it keep its peace. We won't disturb it. Whether the people felt that way about the wood or not is difficult to say. There were some, perhaps, who did. But for the most part, the people followed the road around the wood because that was the way it led. There was no road through the wood. And anyway, for the people, there was another reason to leave the wood to itself. It belonged to the Fosters, the owners of the Touch-Me-Not cottage, and was therefore private property in spite of the fact that it lay outside the fence and was perfectly accessible. The ownership of land is an odd thing when you come to think of it. How deep, after all, can it go? If a person owns a piece of land, does he own it all the way down in ever-narrowing dimensions till it meets all other pieces at the center of the earth? Or does ownership consist only of a thin crust under which the friendly worms have never heard of trespassing? In any case, the wood, being on top, except of course for its roots, was owned bud and bough by the Fosters in the Touch-Me-Not cottage. And if they never went there, if they never wandered in among the trees, well, that was their affair. Winnie, the only child of the house, never went there, though she sometimes stood inside the fence, carelessly banging a stick against the iron bars, and looked at it. But she had never been curious about it. Nothing ever seems interesting when it belongs to you, only when it doesn't. And what is interesting, anyway, about a slim few acres of trees? There will be a dimness shot through with bars of sunlight, a great many squirrels and birds, a deep, damp mattress of leaves on the ground, and all the other things just as familiar, if not so pleasant, things like spiders, thorns, and grubs. In the end, however, it was the cows who were responsible for the wood's isolation. And the cows, through some wisdom they were not wise enough to know that they possessed, were very wise indeed. If they had made their road through the wood instead of around it, then the people would have followed the road. The people would have noticed the giant ash tree at the center of the wood. And then, in time, they'd have noticed the little spring bubbling up among its roots in spite of the pebbles piled there to conceal it. And that would have been a disaster so immense that this weary old earth, owned or not to its fiery core, would have trembled on its axis like a beetle on a pin. 2. And so at dawn that day in the first week of August, May Tuck woke up and lay for a while beaming at the cobwebs on the ceiling. At last she said aloud, "The boys'll be home tomorrow." May's husband, on his back beside her, did not stir. He was still asleep. And the melancholy creases that folded his daytime face were smoothed and slack. He snored gently, and for a moment the corners of his mouth turned upward in a smile. Tuck almost never smiled, except in sleep. May sat up in bed and looked at him tolerantly. "The boys'll be home tomorrow," she said again, a little more loudly. Tuck twitched, and the smile vanished. He opened his eyes.
"Why'd you have to wake me up?"
he sighed. "I was having that dream again. The good one, where we're all in heaven and never heard of Tree Gap." May sat there frowning, a great potato of a woman with a round, sensible face and calm brown eyes. "It's no use having that dream," she said. "Nothing's going to change." "You tell me that every day," said Tuck, turning away from her onto his side. "Anyways, I can't help what I dream." "Maybe not," said May. "But all the same, you should have got used to things by now." Tuck groaned.
"I'm going back to sleep," he said.
"Not me," said May. "I'm going to take the horse and go down to the wood to meet them."
"Meet who?"
"The boys, Tuck. Our sons. I'm going to ride down to meet them."
"Better not do that," said Tuck.
"I know," said May. "But I just can't wait to see them. Anyways, it's 10 years since I went to Tree Gap. No one'll remember me. I'll ride in at sunset just to the wood. I won't go into the village. But even if someone did see me, they won't remember. They never did before. Now did they?"
"Suit yourself, then," said Tuck into his pillow. "I'm going back to sleep."
May Tuck climbed out of bed and began to dress. 3 petticoats, a rusty brown skirt with 1 enormous pocket, an old cotton jacket, and a knitted shawl, which she pinned across her bosom with a tarnished metal brooch. The sounds of her dressing were so familiar to Tuck that he could say without opening his eyes,
"You don't need that shawl in the middle of the summer."
May ignored this observation. Instead, she said, "Will you be all right? We won't get back till late tomorrow." Tuck rolled over and made a rueful face at her.
"What in the world could possibly happen to me?"
"That's so," said May. "I keep forgetting."
"I don't," said Tuck. "Have a nice time."
And in a moment he was asleep again. May sat on the edge of the bed and pulled on a pair of short leather boots so thin and soft with age it was a wonder they held together. Then she stood and took from the washstand beside the bed a little square-shaped object, a music box painted with roses and lilies of the valley. It was the one pretty thing she owned, and she never went anywhere without it. Her fingers strayed to the winding key on its bottom, but glancing at the sleeping Tuck, she shook her head, gave the little box a pat, and dropped it into her pocket. Then, last of all, she pulled down over her ears a blue straw hat with a drooping, exhausted brim. But before she put on the hat, she brushed her gray-brown hair and wound it into a bun at the back of her neck. She did this quickly and skillfully without a single glance in the mirror. Maytuck didn't need a mirror, though she had one propped up on the washstand. She knew very well what she would see in it. Her reflection had long since ceased to interest her. For May Tuck and her husband and Miles and Jesse, too, had all looked exactly the same for 87 years. 3. At noon of that same day in the first week of August, Winnie Foster sat on the bristly grass just inside the fence and said to the large toad, who was squatting a few yards away across the road, "I will, though. You'll see. Maybe even first thing tomorrow, while everyone's still asleep." It was hard to know whether the toad was listening or not.
Certainly, Winnie had given it good reason to ignore her. She had come out to the fence very cross, very near to the boiling point, on a day that was itself near to boiling, and had noticed the toad at once. It was the only living thing in sight, except for a stationary cloud of hysterical gnats suspended in the heat above the road. Winnie had found some pebbles at the base of the fence, and, for lack of any other way to show how she felt, had flung one at the toad. It missed altogether, as she'd fully intended it should. But she made a game of it anyway, tossing pebbles at such an angle that they passed through the gnat cloud on their way to the toad. The gnats were too frantic to notice these intrusions, however, and since every pebble missed its final mark, the toad continued to squat and grimace without so much as a twitch. Possibly it felt resentful, or perhaps it was only asleep. In either case, it gave her not a glance when at last she ran out of pebbles and sat down to tell it her troubles. "Look here, Toad," she said, thrusting her arms through the bars of the fence and plucking at the weeds on the other side. "I don't think I can stand it much longer." At this moment, a window at the front of the cottage was flung open and a thin voice, her grandmother's, piped, "Winfred, don't sit on that dirty grass. You'll stain your boots and stockings." And another firmer voice, her mother's, added, "Come in now, Winnie, right away. You'll get heat stroke out there on a day like this, and your lunch is ready." "See," said Winnie to the toad, "that's just what I mean. It's like that every minute. If I had a sister or a brother, there'd be someone else for them to watch. But as it is, there's only me. I'm tired of being looked at all the time. I want to be by myself for a change." She leaned her forehead against the bars and, after a short silence, went on in a thoughtful tone. "I'm not exactly sure what I do, you know, but something interesting, something that's all mine, something that would make some kind of difference in the world. It'd be nice to have a new name to start with, one that's not all worn out from being called so much. And I might even decide to have a pet, maybe a big old toad like you, that I could keep in a nice cage with lots of grass and—" At this, the toad stirred and blinked. It gave a heave of muscles and plopped its heavy mud ball of a body a few inches farther away from her. "I suppose you're right," said Winnie. "Then you'd be just the way I am now. Why should you have to be cooped up in a cage, too? It'd be better if I could be like you, out in the open and making up my own mind. Do you know, they've hardly ever let me out of this yard all by myself? I'll never be able to do anything important if I stay in here like this. I expect I'd better run away." She paused and peered anxiously at the toad, to see how it would receive this staggering idea, but it showed no signs of interest. "You think I wouldn't dare, don't you?" she said accusingly. "I will, though. You'll see. Maybe even first thing in the morning, while everyone's still asleep."
"Winnie!"
came the firm voice from the window.
"All right, I'm coming!" she cried, exasperated, and then added quickly, "I mean, I'll be right there, Mama."
She stood up, brushing at her legs, where bits of itchy grass clung to her stockings. The toad, as if it saw that their interview was over, stirred again, bunched up, and bounced itself clumsily off toward the wood. Winnie watched it go.
"Hop away, Toad," she called after it. "You'll see. Just wait till morning."
4. At sunset of that same long day, a stranger came strolling up the road from the village and paused at the Foster's gate. Winnie was once again in the yard, this time intent on catching fireflies, and at first she didn't notice him. But after a few moments of watching her, he called out,
"Good evening."
He was remarkably tall and narrow, this stranger standing there. His long chin faded off into a thin, apologetic beard, but his suit was a jaunty yellow that seemed to glow a little in the fading light. A black hat dangled from one hand, and as Winnie came toward him, he passed the other through his dry, gray hair, settling it smoothly. "Well, now," he said in a light voice, "out for fireflies, are you?"
"Yes," said Winnie.
"A lovely thing to do on a summer evening," said the man richly. "A lovely entertainment. I used to do it myself when I was your age, but of course that was a long, long time ago." He laughed, gesturing in self-deprecation with long, thin fingers. His tall body moved continuously. A foot tapped, a shoulder twitched, and it moved in angles, rather jerkily. But at the same time, he had a kind of grace, like a well-handled marionette. Indeed, he seemed almost to hang, suspended there in the twilight. But Winnie, though she was half-charmed, was suddenly reminded of the stiff black ribbons they had hung on the door of the cottage for her grandfather's funeral. She frowned and looked at the man more closely, but his smile seemed perfectly all right, quite agreeable and friendly. "Is this your house?" asked the man, folding his arms now and leaning against the gate.
"Yes," said Winnie. "Do you want to see my father?"
"Perhaps in a bit," said the man. "But I'd like to talk to you first. Have you and your family lived here long?"
"Oh, yes," said Winnie. "We've lived here forever."
"Forever?" the man echoed thoughtfully.
It was not a question, but Winnie decided to explain anyway.
"Well, not forever, of course, but as long as there've been any people here. My grandmother was born here. She says this was all trees once, just one big forest everywhere around. But it's mostly all cut down now, except for the wood."
"I see," said the man, pulling at his beard. "So, of course, you know everyone and everything that goes on."
"Well, not especially," said Winnie. "At least, I don't. Why?"
The man lifted his eyebrows.
"Oh," he said, "I'm looking for someone, a family."
"I don't know anybody much," said Winnie with a shrug, "but my father might. You could ask him."
"I believe I shall," said the man. "I do believe I shall."
At this moment, the cottage door opened, and in the lamp glow that spilled across the grass, Winnie's grandmother appeared.
"Winifred, who are you talking to out there?"
"It's a man, Granny," she called back. "He says he's looking for someone."
"What's that?"
said the old woman. She picked up her skirts and came down the path to the gate.
"What did you say he wants?"
The man on the other side of the fence bowed slightly.
"Good evening, madam," he said. "How delightful to see you looking so fit."
"And why shouldn't I be fit?"
she retorted, peering at him through the fading light. His yellow suit seemed to surprise her, and she squinted suspiciously.
"We haven't met, that I can recall. Who are you? Who are you looking for?"
The man answered neither of these questions. Instead, he said,
"This young lady tells me you've lived here for a long time, so I thought you would probably know everyone who comes and goes."
The old woman shook her head.
"I don't know everyone," she said, "nor do I want to. And I don't stand outside in the dark discussing such a thing with strangers. Neither does Winifred, so..."
And then she paused. for through the twilight sounds of crickets and sighing trees, a faint, surprising wisp of music came floating to them, and all three turned toward it, toward the wood. It was a tinkling little melody, and in a few moments it stopped.
"My stars!" said Winnie's grandmother, her eyes round. "I do believe it's come again, after all these years!"
She pressed her wrinkled hands together, forgetting the man in the yellow suit.
"Did you hear that, Winifred? That's it! That's the elf music I told you about! Why, it's been ages since I heard it last! And this is the first time you've ever heard it, isn't it? Wait till we tell your father!"
And she seized Winnie's hand and turned to go back into the cottage.
"Wait!" said the man at the gate. He had stiffened, and his voice was eager. "You've heard that music before, you say?"
But before he could get an answer, it began again, and they all stopped to listen. This time it tinkled its way faintly through the little melody three times before it faded.
"It sounds like a music box," said Winnie when it was over.
"Nonsense! It's elves!"
crowed her grandmother excitedly. And then she said to the man at the gate,
"You'll have to excuse us now."
She shook the gate latch under his nose to make sure it was locked, and then, taking Winnie by the hand once more, she marched up the path into the cottage, shutting the door firmly behind her.
But the man in the yellow suit stood tapping his foot in the road for a long time, all alone, looking at the wood. The last stains of sunset had melted away, and the twilight died too as he stood there, though its remnants clung reluctantly to everything that was pale in color. Pebbles, the dusty road, the figure of the man himself, turning them blue and blurry. Then the moon rose. The man came to himself and sighed. His expression was one of intense satisfaction. He put on his hat, and in the moonlight, his long fingers were graceful and very white. Then he turned and disappeared down the shadowy road, and as he went, he whistled very softly the tinkling little melody from the wood.
5. Winnie woke early next morning. The sun was only just opening its own eye on the eastern horizon, and the cottage was full of silence. But she realized that sometime during the night, she had made up her mind. She would not run away today.
"Where would I go anyway?" she asked herself. "There's nowhere else I really want to be."
But in another part of her head, the dark part, where her oldest fears were housed, she knew there was another sort of reason for staying at home. She was afraid to go away alone. It was one thing to talk about being by yourself, doing important things, but quite another when the opportunity arose. The characters in the stories she read always seemed to go off without a thought or care. But in real life, well, the world was a dangerous place. People were always telling her so, and she would not be able to manage without protection. They were always telling her that, too. No one ever said precisely what it was that she would not be able to manage, but she did not need to ask. Her own imagination supplied the horrors. Still, it was galling, this having to admit she was afraid. And when she remembered the toad, she felt even more disheartened. What if the toad should be out by the fence again today? What if he should laugh at her secretly and think she was a coward? Well, anyway, she could at least slip out right now, she decided, and go into the wood, to see if she could discover what had really made the music the night before. That would be something, anyway. She did not allow herself to consider the idea that making a difference in the world might require a bolder venture. She merely told herself consolingly,
"Of course, while I'm in the wood, if I decide never to come back, well then, that will be that."
She was able to believe in this because she needed to, and believing was her own true, promising friend once more. It was another heavy morning, already hot and breathless. But in the wood, the air was cooler and smelled agreeably damp. Winnie had been no more than 2 slow minutes walking timidly under the interlacing branches when she wondered why she had never come here before. "Why, it's nice," she thought with great surprise. For the wood was full of light, entirely different from the light she was used to. It was green and amber and alive, quivering in splotches on the padded ground, fanning into sturdy stripes between the tree trunks. There were little flowers she did not recognize, white and palest blue, and endless tangled vines, and here and there a fallen log, half-rotted but soft with patches of sweet green velvet moss. And there were creatures everywhere. The air fairly hummed with their daybreak activity, beetles and birds and squirrels and ants, and countless other things unseen, all gentle and self-absorbed and not in the least alarming. There was even, she saw with satisfaction, the toad. It was squatting on a low stump, and she might not have noticed it, for it looked more like a mushroom than a living creature sitting there. As she came abreast of it, however, it blinked, and the movement gave it away. "See?" she exclaimed. "I told you I'd be here first thing in the morning." The toad blinked again and nodded, or perhaps it was only swallowing a fly. But then it nudged itself off the edge of the stump and vanished in the underbrush. "It must have been watching for me," said Winnie to herself, and was very glad she had come. She wandered for a long time, looking at everything, listening to everything, proud to forget the tight-pruned world outside, humming a little now, trying to remember the pattern of the melody she had heard the night before. And then, up ahead, in a place where the light seemed brighter and the ground somewhat more open, something moved. Winnie stopped abruptly and crouched down. "If it's really elves," she thought, "I can have a look at them." And though her instinct was to turn and run, she was pleased to discover that her curiosity was stronger. She began to creep forward. She would go just close enough, she told herself, just close enough to see, and then she would turn and run. But when she came near, up behind a sheltering tree trunk, and peered around it, her mouth dropped open, and all thought of running melted away. There was a clearing directly in front of her, at the center of which an enormous tree thrust up its thick roots, rumpling the ground 10 feet around in every direction. Sitting relaxed with his back against the trunk was a boy, almost a man, and he seemed so glorious to Winnie that she lost her heart at once. He was thin and sunburned, this wonderful boy, with a thick mop of curly brown hair, and he wore his battered trousers and loose, grubby shirt with as much self-assurance as if they were silken satin. A pair of green suspenders, more decorative than useful, gave the finishing touch, for he was shoeless, and there was a twig tucked between the toes of one foot. He waved the twig idly as he sat there, his face turned up to gaze at the branches far above him. The golden morning light seemed to glow all around him, while brighter patches fell now on his lean brown hands, now on his hair and face, as the leaves stirred over his head. Then he rubbed an ear carelessly, yawned, and stretched. Shifting his position, he turned his attention to a little pile of pebbles next to him. As Winnie watched, scarcely breathing, he moved the pile carefully to one side, pebble by pebble. Beneath the pile, the ground was shiny wet. The boy lifted a final stone, and Winnie saw a low spurt of water arching up and returning like a fountain into the ground. He bent and put his lips to the spurt, drinking noiselessly, and then he sat up again and drew his shirt sleeve across his mouth. As he did this, he turned his face in her direction, and their eyes met. For a long moment they looked at each other in silence, the boy with his arms still raised to his mouth. Neither of them moved. At last his arm fell to his side. "You may as well come out," he said with a frown. Winnie stood up, embarrassed, and because of that, resentful. "I didn't mean to watch you," she protested as she stepped into the clearing. "I didn't know anyone would be here." The boy eyed her as she came forward. "What are you doing here?" he asked her sternly. "It's my wood," said Winnie, surprised by the question. "I can come here whenever I want to. At least, I was never here before, but I could have come any time." "Oh?" said the boy, relaxing a little. "You're one of the Fosters, then."
"I'm Winnie," she said. "Who are you?"
"I'm Jesse Tuck," he answered. "How do?" And he put out a hand. Winnie took his hand, staring at him. He was even more beautiful up close.
"Do you live nearby?"
she managed at last, letting go of his hand reluctantly.
"I never saw you before. Do you come here a lot?"
"No one's supposed to. It's our wood," then she added quickly. "It's all right, though, if you come here. I mean, it's all right with me." The boy grinned. "No, I don't live nearby. And no, I don't come here often. Just passing through. And thanks, I'm glad it's all right with you."
"That's good," said Winnie, irrelevantly. She stepped back and sat down primly a short distance from him. "How old are you anyway?" she asked, squinting at him.
There was a pause. At last he said, "Why do you want to know?"
"I just wondered," said Winnie.
"All right. I'm 104 years old," he told her solemnly.
"No, I mean really," she persisted.
"Well then," he said, "if you must know, I'm 17.
17?
"That's right." "Oh," said Winnie hopelessly, 17. "That's old." "You have no idea," he agreed with a nod.
Winnie had the feeling he was laughing at her, but decided it was a nice kind of laughing. "Are you married?" she asked next.
This time he laughed out loud. "No, I'm not married. Are you?" Now it was Winnie's turn to laugh.
"Of course not," she said. "I'm only 10, but I'll be 11 pretty soon."
"And then you'll get married," he suggested. Winnie laughed again, her head on one side, admiring him. And then she pointed to the spurt of water.
"Is that good to drink?" she asked. "I'm thirsty."
Jesse Tuck's face was instantly serious. No, it's not," he said quickly. "You mustn't drink from it. Comes right up out of the ground, probably pretty dirty." And he began to pile the pebbles over it again.
"But you drank some," Winnie reminded him.
"Oh, did you see that?" He looked at her anxiously. "Well, me, I'll drink anything. I mean, I'm used to it. It wouldn't be good for you, though."
"Why not?" said Winnie. She stood up. "It's mine anyway, if it's in the wood. I want some. I'm about dry as dust." And she went to where he sat and knelt down beside the pile of pebbles.
"Believe me, Winnie Foster," said Jesse, "it would be terrible for you if you drank any of this water. Just terrible. I can't let you."
"Well, I still don't see why not,"
said Winnie plaintively. I'm getting thirstier every minute. If it didn't hurt you, it won't hurt me. If my papa was here, he'd let me have some.
You're not going to tell him about it, are you? Said Jesse. His face had gone very pale under its sunburn. He stood up and put a bare foot firmly on the pile of pebbles.
I knew this would happen sooner or later. Now what am I going to do?
As he said this, there was a crashing sound among the trees, and a voice called, Jesse!
Thank goodness, said Jesse, blowing out his cheeks in relief. Here comes Ma and Miles. They'll know what to do.
And sure enough, a big, comfortable-looking woman appeared, leading a fat old horse, and at her side was a young man almost as beautiful as Jesse. It was May Tuck with her other son, Jesse's older brother. And at once, when she saw the two of them, Jesse with his foot on the pile of pebbles and Winnie on her knees beside him, she seemed to understand. Her hand flew to her bosom, grasping at the old brooch that fastened her shawl, and her face went bleak.
Well, boys, she said, here it is. The worst is happening at last.
6. Afterward, when she thought about it, it seemed to Winnie that the next few minutes were only a blur. First, she was kneeling on the ground, insisting on a drink from the spring. And the next thing she knew, she was seized and swung through the air, open-mouthed, and found herself straddling the bouncing back of the fat old horse with Miles and Jesse trotting along on either side, while May ran, puffing ahead, dragging on the bridle. Winnie had often been haunted by visions of what it would be like to be kidnapped. But none of her visions had been like this, with her kidnappers just as alarmed as she was herself. She had always pictured a troop of burly men with long black mustaches who would tumble her into a blanket and bear her off like a sack of potatoes while she pleaded for mercy. But instead, it was they, May, Tuck, and Miles, and Jesse, who were pleading,
"Please, child! Dear, dear child, don't you be scared."
This was May, trying to run and call back over her shoulder at the same time.
"We wouldn't harm you for the world."
"If you'd yelled or anything,"
this was Jesse,
"someone might have heard you, and that's too risky."
And Miles said,
"We'll explain it soon as we're far enough away."
Winnie herself was speechless. She clung to the saddle and gave herself up to the astonishing fact that though her heart was pounding and her backbone felt like a pipe full of cold running water, her head was fiercely calm. Disconnected thoughts presented themselves one by one as if they had been waiting their turn in line. So this is what it's like to ride a horse. I was going to run away today anyway. What will they say when I'm not there for breakfast? I wish the toad could see me now. That woman is worried about me. Miles is taller than Jesse. I'd better duck if I don't want this next branch to knock me off. They had come to the edge of the wood now, with no sign of slowing their rapid jog. The road, where it angled across the meadow, was just ahead, dazzling white in the open sunlight. And there, standing on the road, was the man from the night before, the man in the yellow suit, his black hat on his head. Discovering him, seeing his surprise, and presented at once with choices, Winnie's mind perversely went blank. Instead of crying out for help, she merely goggled at him as they fled past the spot where he stood. May Tuck was the only one who spoke, and the most she could offer was,
"Teaching our little girl how to ride."
Only then did it come to Winnie that she ought to shout, wave her arms, do something. But the man had fallen away behind by that time, and she was afraid to let go of the saddle, afraid to turn around lest she fall off the horse. In another moment, it was too late. They had sped up the hill and down its other side, and the opportunity was lost. After another few minutes, the road led them to a place where, off to the left, a shallow stream looped near, with willows and sheltering, scrubby brushes.
"Stop!" cried May. "We'll stop here."
Miles and Jesse grabbed at the horse's harness, and he pulled up abruptly, nearly toppling Winnie off over his neck.
"Lift the poor child down," May gasped, her chest heaving. "We'll go catch our breath by the water and try to put things straight before we go on."
But the explanation, once they had stumbled to the banks of the stream, came hard. May seemed embarrassed, and Miles and Jesse fidgeted, glancing at their mother uneasily. No one knew how to begin. For her part, Winnie, now that the running was over, began to comprehend what was happening. And with the comprehension, her throat closed, and her mouth went dry as paper. This was no vision. This was real. Strangers were taking her away. They might do anything. She might never see her mother again. And then, thinking of her mother, she saw herself as small, weak, and helpless. And she began to cry, suddenly crushed as much by outrage as by shock. May Tuck's round face wrinkled in dismay.
"Dear Lord, don't cry. Please, don't cry, child," she implored. "We're not bad people, truly we're not. We had to bring you away. You'll see why in a minute, and we'll take you back just as soon as we can. Tomorrow, I promise."
When May said, "Tomorrow," Winnie's sobs turned to wails.
"Tomorrow?" It was like being told she would be kept away forever. She wanted to go home now, at once, rush back to the safety of the fence and her mother's voice from the window.
May reached out to her, but she twisted away, her hands over her face, and gave herself up to weeping.
"This is awful," said Jesse. "Can't you do something, Ma? The poor little tad."
"We ought to have had some better plan than this," said Miles.
"That's the truth," said May helplessly.
"The dear Lord knows there's been time enough to think of one, and it had to happen sooner or later. We've been plain bone lucky it hasn't before now. But I never expected it'd be a child."
She reached distractedly into the pocket of her skirt and took out the music box, and without thinking, twisted the winding key with trembling fingers. When the tinkling little melody began, Winnie's sobbing slowed. She stood by the stream, her hands still over her face, and listened. Yes, it was the same music she had heard the night before. Somehow it calmed her. It was like a ribbon tying her to familiar things. She thought, "When I get home, I'll tell Granny it wasn't elf music after all." She wiped her face as well as she could with her wet hands and turned to May.
"That's the music I heard last night," she managed between recovering snuffles. "When I was out in my yard, my granny said it was elves."
"Dear me, no," said May, peering at her hopefully.
"It's only my music box. I didn't suppose anyone could hear it."
She held it out to Winnie. "Do you want to take a look at it?"
"It's pretty," said Winnie, taking the little box and turning it over in her hands.
The winding key was still revolving, but more and more slowly. The melody faltered. Another few widely spaced notes plinked, and then it stopped.
"Wind it up if you want to," said May, "clockwise."
Winnie turned the key. It clicked faintly. And then, after several more turns, the music began to play again, brisk from its fresh winding, and merry. No one who owned a thing like this could be too disagreeable. Winnie examined the painted roses and lilies of the valley and smiled in spite of herself.
"It's pretty," she repeated.
handing it back to May. The music box had relaxed them all. Miles dragged a handkerchief from a back pocket and mopped at his face, and May sank down heavily on a rock, pulling off the blue straw hat and fanning herself with it.
"Look here, Winnie Foster," said Jessie. "We're friends. We really are. But you got to help us. Come sit down, and we'll try to tell you why."
7. It was the strangest story Winnie had ever heard. She soon suspected they had never told it before, except to each other, that she was their first real audience. For they gathered around her like children at their mother's knee, each trying to claim her attention, and sometimes they all talked at once and interrupted each other in their eagerness. 87 years before, the Tucks had come from a long way to the east looking for a place to settle. In those days, the wood was not a wood, it was a forest, just as her grandmother had said. A forest that went on and on and on. They had thought they would start a farm as soon as they came to the end of the trees. But the trees never seemed to end. When they came to the part that was now the wood and turned from the trail to find a camping place, they happened on the spring. "It was real nice," said Jessie with a sigh. "It looked just the way it does now. A clearing, lots of sunshine, that big tree with all those knobby roots. We stopped, and everyone took a drink, even the horse."
"No," said May. "The cat didn't drink. That's important."
"Yes," said Miles. "Don't leave that out. We all had a drink, except for the cat."
"Well, anyway," Jessie went on, "the water tasted sort of strange, but we camped there overnight, and Pa carved a T on the tree trunk to mark where we'd been, and then we went on."
They had come out of the forest at last, many miles to the west, had found a thinly populated valley, had started their farm.
"We put up a house for Ma and Pa," said Miles, "and a little shack for Jessie and me. We figured we'd be starting families of our own pretty soon and would want our own houses."
"That was the first time we figured there was something peculiar," said May. "Jessie fell out of a tree."
"I was way up in the middle," Jessie interrupted, "trying to saw off some of the big branches before we cut her down. I lost my balance and I fell."
"He landed plumb on his head," said May with a shudder. "We thought for sure he'd broke his neck. But come to find out, it didn't hurt him a bit."
"Not long after," Miles went on, "some hunters come by one day at sunset. The horse was out grazing by some trees, and they shot him. Mistook him for a deer, they said. Can you fancy that? But the thing is, they didn't kill him. The bullet went right on through him and didn't hardly even leave a mark. Then Pa got snake bite, and Jessie ate the poison toadstools, and I cut myself," said May. "Remember, slicing bread."
But it was the passage of time that worried them most. They had worked the farm, settled down, made friends. But after 10 years, then 20, they had to face the fact that there was something terribly wrong. None of them was getting any older.
"I was more'n 40 by then," said Miles sadly. "I was married. I had 2 children. But from the look of me, I was still 22. My wife, she finally made up her mind. I'd sold my soul to the devil. She left me. She went away and she took the children with her." "I'm glad I never got married," Jessie put in.
"It was the same with our friends," said May.
They come to pull back from us. There was talk about witchcraft, black magic. Well, you can't hardly blame them. But finally, we had to leave the farm. We didn't know where to go. We started back the way we come, just wandering. We was like gypsies. When we got this far, it had changed, of course. A lot of the trees was gone. There was people and Tree Gap. It was a new village. The road was here, but in those days it was mostly just a cow path. We went on into what was left of the wood to make a camp, and when we got to the clearing and the tree and the spring, we remembered it from before. It hadn't changed no more'n we had, said Miles. And that was how we found out. Pod carved a T on the tree, remember, 20 years before. But the T was just where it had been when he'd done it. That tree hadn't grown one whit in all that time. It was exactly the same. And the T he'd carved was as fresh as if it had just been put there. Then they had remembered drinking the water. They and the horse, but not the cat. The cat had lived a long and happy life on the farm, but had died some 10 years before. So they decided at last that the source of their changelessness was the spring. When we come to that conclusion, May went on, Tuck said, that's my husband, Angus Tuck, he said he had to be sure once and for all. He took his shotgun, and he pointed it at himself the best way he could, and before we could stop him, he pulled the trigger. There was a long pause. May's fingers, laced together in her lap, twisted with the tension of remembering. At last she said, The shot knocked him down. Went into his heart. It had to, the way he aimed, and right on through him. It scarcely even left a mark. Just like, you know, like you shot a bullet through water. And he was just the same as if he'd never done it. After that, we went sort of crazy, said Jesse, grinning at the memory. Heck, we was going to live forever. Can you picture what it felt like to find that out? But then we sat down and talked it over, said Miles. We're still talking it over, Jesse added. And we figured it'd be very bad if everyone knowed about that spring, said May. We begun to see what it would mean. She peered at Winnie. Do you understand, child? That water, it stops you right where you are. If you'd had a drink of it today, you'd stay a little girl forever. You'd never grow up, not ever. We don't know how it works or even why, said Miles. Pa thinks it's something left over from, well, from some other plan for the way the world should be, said Jesse. Some plan that didn't work out too good. And so everything was changed, except that the spring was passed over somehow or other. Maybe he's right. I don't know. But you see, Winnie Foster, when I told you before I'm 104 years old, I was telling the truth. But I'm really only 17. And so far as I know, I'll stay 17 till the end of the world.